This is where the whole community just comes together for one day, more so than any other ultra in the US. This is the one that really attracts people, whether they're pacing or whether they're in the race themselves. So it's just the community side of it that I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And I want to get back in. So I'm not done yet.
Welcome to the Trailhead of Trail Runner Nation, where we go on virtual trail runs with really interesting guests that help us and teach us how to be better runners and hopefully better human beings. If it's your first time, you are more than welcome to join us. Lace up the shoes. Let's get going, Freeman.
Hey, and this podcast, a little bit different because we're sitting live at a running store called the Aid Station in Auburn. And in front of us, the International Runners. And on the guest panel, two amazing guests that have run this race 35 times.
Tim and Ian know something about this course, and they're going to help our international runners and hopefully you, even if you're never going to run Western States. Some of the principles they're going to talk about translate into each run, each race that you're doing.
This episode brought to us by Exoskin.
Exoskin has been a partner of ours for a very long time. And this quarter, they have partnered with us and our Patreon supporters, and they have given every Patreon subscriber of Trail Runner Nation a $25 gift code that they can redeem at exoskin.us.
You can buy anything you want, whether it comes from arm sleeves, socks, baseliners, they have it all.
And I love their toe socks. We're talking about Western States today on this episode. And my Western States was not great. Lots of blisters. If I had Exoskin back then, I probably wouldn't have had that issue.
Well, Scott, I saw your feet at the end, and I think that's what inspired Exoskin to manufacture something because you were in bad shape.
Go to exoskin.us and use the code TRN. You can get an additional 10% off their already low direct-to-consumer discounts. We also want to let you know about a really cool partner that's become a recent partner that we believe in strongly, Inside Tracker. It's very easy to think about your strength training and your endurance training and your cardiovascular training. But the part that is sometimes invisible to us is what's going on inside biologically and chemically. We need to know what's going on in order for us to reach our potential.
Well, Scott, you may not be able to see it, but Inside Tracker can with their great labs. But you know where else you can see it? You can see it in your performance, and you can feel it on the trail. When things just don't feel right, sometimes you need to take a look inside and see what's going on.
They have a bunch of different plans. If you go to our website, trailrunnernation.com, click on the deals at the very top, you can get 20% off any of the plans that they have there.
4 weeks ago, we did a podcast with Inside Tracker's Ashley Reaver, and she gave us the biomarkers that are most important for endurance athletes to perform well.
Find out what's going on inside you by going to our deals page and clicking on the link at Inside Tracker.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And this is a special edition. Don and I, for the last 2 years, have recorded this a weekly podcast, and we have not been face-to-face. Now, we've gone running together, but we haven't recorded a podcast face-to-face in two and a half years.
Right? We've settled into our virtual worlds, and I don't come out of the house.
We like recording in our pajamas. And so this is kind of fun. We're actually at the Aid Station in Auburn, California, which is a local running store. It's a great place. If you're ever in Auburn, you need to come by. It's on Lincoln Street. You can't miss it. They have lots of fun running gear. It's specific to running and trail running. They have local trail runs. Paula, what days do you do runs? Thursdays. Every Thursday is at 6 p.m. You can come by here. You can go for a run. Paulo knows the trails. He leads all of them, right? And then you can come back here and you can socialize, grab a beer because they have a liquor license, and just enjoy each other's company, which is what we're all about as a community.
And we have a big race coming up, Scott. It's just not the Thursday runs. We are talking about Western States, and we brought two guests, Ian Sharman and Tim Tweetmeyer. And they were selected for obvious reasons. Both have great legacy here at Western States. Ian has one. Let me read what I put down for Ian. You guys probably think we have all this on the top of our head, but we cheat quite a bit. We're on the podcast. He currently holds the records for the Grand Slam of ultra running and is the winner of the 2013, 2015, 2016, 2017 Leadville Trail 100. And he has a 1,000-mile Western States buckle, which means he's run this 10 times and has earned a buckle for each one of them. Many of the runners that are lining up at Olympic Valley are hoping to get just one of those buckles, and that is a admirable goal.
Can I add something, Don?
Would you please?
One of the, and you're going to have to correct me because you know the actual details. We don't know any details. But Ian has the fastest cumulative time for those 10 times running. So if you add up all of his finish times, he's done it faster than anyone else has done it 10 times.
In fairness, not many people have done it, though. Although it is about 40. And also, I just want to point out that when you said who the other person was going to be on, it's like, do you want me to bring my 10-year buckle? You know, it's kind of cool. And they said, Tim Tweetmeyer's here. It's like, oh, well, that makes mine look like the JV version because he's got a 25-year buckle.
Yeah, let's give
That's Tim. A great introduction for our next guest.
Better than I could ever do. But let's introduce Tim for those who don't know him around here. And Tim is an amazing runner in this area, but all over the world, really. He has 5 Cougars here at Western States, 5 times the fastest runner. 25 times he's raced under 24 hours. No one else has ever done that. He served for 25 years on the board of Western States, so he knows a lot about it. And he is the vice president, currently serves on the board as vice president. Vice president of what? Just things?
Old stuff. Okay. Stuff that the new guys don't know yet.
Yeah. So, and
I want to say, I would bet that if Tim laced up his shoes on Saturday morning, he could do it well under 24 hours. I saw him out at American River 50-mile race not too long ago, and he finished, and it didn't even look like he broke a sweat.
So I did a little background. I went to Wikipedia because that's
oh boy, the source of all
that's,
facts.
That's as far as our research goes.
really digging deep there for another round, Don.
I think that Tim probably has access to that because it also reads this way. He is an accomplished mountain biker, road cyclist, and retired almost scratch golfer, and he throws in swimmer. So, I mean, if you're going to write your own stuff, you might as well just add a few other sports in there.
Dog trainer.
All of it. So we're really happy to have both of these guys because really they together have run this thing 35 times, and that's a lot of experience.
And if you're listening to this, we have a live audience here, but if you're listening to this, this recording, we're recording on Wednesday afternoon, which is the Wednesday afternoon before the Saturday morning start. And our purpose of having this is we have a nice group of international runners that are here, and we're hopefully going to shed some light on this Western States course, which has been coined by Joe Juhan, who's run the race, the killing machine. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit, why he coined it the killing machine. But we're hopefully going to give the international runners that are here, that are going to be towing the line on Saturday, some tips and tricks and hopefully some inspiration as you head out on the trail Saturday morning.
Now, everybody here has a story, how they got into the race, how many times they've tried, how many times they've waited, or miraculously, how you got in on the first time. I don't know, but we all have a story to tell. And I'm interested in hearing Ian's story, his first time. How did you get in your very first time? And it's coming to you. You'll see the trend here, Tim. How did you get in your
what year?
2010. So it was the Unbreakable movie year.
Okay.
With Anton Kropitschka and Killian and Jeff Rose winning it with the course record. So that movie, if you haven't seen it, is absolutely amazing. So that was kind of an iconic one to do, but I got in first time in the lottery, one ticket. Hmm. And that was at a point where I think it was 2008 maybe, where it had been canceled due to fire. Is that the year?
Yeah. 2008.
Yeah. So 2009, everyone was in automatically. And it meant that 2010, there weren't as many places, I think, in the lottery possibly. So I was very lucky. And then I just made sure that, because it's so difficult to get in, the only guaranteed way is getting top 10. So I just tried to make sure I could do that and then failed on the 10th out of 10. So that's why I'm not in it right now. Otherwise, I will keep doing it.
Nice.
To give context to that, let's talk about the lottery. We've talked about it on the podcast many times, but let's bring that back up to give context on how hard it is to get in to Western States through the lottery. They have a rolling average of 381,
369.
369, I was close. That's the 369.
You recorded a podcast about a week ago, and AJW was telling you that one.
Wait, AJW had a fax?
He got it right. Yeah. There were some other ones maybe not, but that
hey,
one's
Don, right. Hey, Don, Ian listens to the podcast.
We were wondering who did.
So it's 369.
Right.
And this year, how many entrants were there, Tim? Like 6,000?
I think there's a few. Yeah, 6,000 was about the round number of the number of people that applied.
So 6,000 people want to run this race where only 369 on average can run. So the whole reason I bring this up is it's really, really hard to get in this race. And so for Ian, even in 2010, to get in with one ticket was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And I hadn't done a 100-miler before. When I got into Western States, I entered the Rocky Raccoon 100-miler earlier that year, just so I could get in something longer to feel prepared before I came here. And I DNF'd there, partly because I was injured the whole 2 months before, and I was only able to run again about a week before. So I got in 80 miles, longest run of my life, and I was very happy with that. And I said, nope, I just want to walk away with this able to run. But it doesn't give you a whole lot of confidence if you DNF, and then you have Western States. So yeah, the first year I came here, it was just aiming to finish. That was the number one thing. Is no matter what happens, no matter how bad it gets, and this is what I'd recommend to everyone listening and people here in particular, just tell yourself that even if you want the 24-hour buckle or something, whatever time may appeal to you the most, tell yourself you've got to finish. Because if you have that as your backstop, you'll deal with things that go wrong better, and you're much more likely than to get it back on track and maybe still get that A goal.
Ian, I'm going to ask you after I hear Tim's story about what was your experience? You DNF'd your first 100. You show up here. It's a mystery what the 100 finish looks like. I want to hear about how that first race went and what you would have changed, what you learned through that journey. But Tim, how about your first 100-mile race at Western States? It started a series of 25 starts.
Yeah, so I ran the first time. I was entered in 1980 and didn't run. That was the year I graduated from college and was banged up and figured, well,
and the year I was born.
And so I passed and said, hey, just keep my entry in for 81. So then by that year, I was able to go and do some other events because, you know, that was when they had the old Tahoe 72 around the lake on the pavement. You know, American River was here, Jed Smith. I'm trying to think any other events at the time. Nugget 50 up in the Malakoff Diggings around Nevada City was kind of a popular. It was mostly events that had come out of horse rides. And I ran my first year in 1981 and just made it a bit under 24 hours. I was kind of with, you know, just get out there. You know, yeah, you want to do 24, but the number one thing is just get done and finish it. Because then once you know what it's like to do it, then you can make some adjustments and, you know, burn it up the next time.
80 or 81?
81.
81, yeah. Was there a lottery? Or if you wanted to run, could you get in?
No, I think there it was just first come, first serve for a while. It wasn't long after that, though. I want to say by 83, 84, there was already a lottery. You know, it wasn't too long before they had to go to that because kind of it was weird how Western States and Ironman kind of grew an exponential all at the same time. They both are in parallel going bananas, you know, with some of the TV coverage and all the write-ups and magazines. It was like everybody kind of started getting. And then once that momentum got going, boy, it was really hard to get in.
Ian, what did you learn after your first trip down that Squaw Valley?
I learned that it helps to do heat training because I didn't do any because I thought I could get away with it maybe because I didn't realize quite how hot it would be. But yeah, there's a whole load of things in your first 100 that everyone will make mistakes. And the first time you do Western States, because it's a little bit different to other ones. I've spoken to people who have done UTMB, which takes longer, but it's just different types of challenges. It's more runnable here. But there's the heat versus the crash legs from all the downhills, that kind of thing. But I think that the main thing was just that if you force yourself to keep going, you can. So I just had it back in my mind that there was no way I was DNFing because I just had that at Rocky Raccoon. So I wanted to finish no matter what. And I said, yeah, it'd be great to be near the front. And if I have a good race, I was in good shape. I didn't think I was going to be at the back of the pack, but I also had no idea how it would work out. So I just said to myself, yeah, even if I'm having a bad day, you got to suck it up and finish it. And I had that mentality and I was willing to do 29:59, which meant that I didn't have to do 29:59. And that I think is a key element to doing well in any race, to be honest, but I learned that from that first Western States.
Do you remember your time from the first Western States?
17 and a half.
Oh, please. That's a far cry from 29, pal.
And that was with some bad patches in there. Like when I overheated on the way down to the river, I was literally wobbling and dizzy, so I couldn't walk straight. And so then when I got to the river, I was able to cool down a little bit. And that's what I mean. I learned that I need to do some heat training.
Wow.
A little caveat here. If you're listening to the recording, or if you're out here and you're not racing this race this year, a lot of the things that we're going to talk about translate into really any race that you're doing. So what Ian just told us there with what he learned, other races may not have the heat, but the philosophy of keep going, do whatever it takes, problem solve, that's going to help you with any race that you're doing.
And just to point out that it's not saying just be willing to have a second best day or don't try, or it doesn't matter if you don't do well, but you only do well if you're willing to have bad patches. That's the big difference between a 100 miler and a shorter race, is that you can run a marathon, have a good day, nothing goes wrong. You can run a 100 miler, have things go wrong, and still have a perfect day. Like that year when Jeff Rose won, he didn't have a perfect day. He got the course record, but he had a patch where he got dropped by the leaders. He was struggling, so he had to slow down a bit, looked after himself, ate some food. Then he charged forward, overtook them, and got the win. But you pretty much never have a perfect day. So if you assume it's going to be like that, you'll always drop out.
One of the best pieces of advice that someone gave me, and it was probably Don, he said...
I'll take credit for it.
Yeah, yeah. He said, the bus is going to hit you at some point. So just be prepared for the bus to hit you. And the time that I ran Western States, I was waiting for it. I was anticipating it almost with some giddy delight, because I knew that it was going to hit me. And I was waiting for it to hit me, and I was ready for it to hit me, so that when it happened, it was almost like, woohoo, the bus hit me, let's get on.
Yeah, the escarpment.
Which is mile 3.
Yeah. 4.5. So Tim, just tell us about your first trip down that hill.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. You know, in those days, they really didn't have any... Nobody really had run 100 miles, right, or 80 miles, and even 100 Ks were pretty unusual. I mean, the longest run people would do in racing was 50 miles, right? So you did that, you went and ran on the course, but you had to find a native guide, because there was no trail marking. Nobody mm-hmm. knew where the course went. There was no, you know, Google Maps or Gaia to just drop it onto your phone and just wander around by yourself, right? You had to have somebody take you out there. But I think the thing that always got back to me was there's kind of this point at where you're running farther than you've ever run in your life that first time. And that's the mystery play for the people that are new. This is your first 100 miler. Maybe you've run 100 K, maybe you've done 50 mile training runs, but it's that, you know, 60 miles to 100 miles where all the fun begins, right? That's what I think. That's where Ian and Scott were saying. Definitely. That's where the bus crossings are. You need to get through those without getting hit too hard. But
there was a few train crossings there too.
Yeah. And that's what makes it fascinating. I think that when you walk up Roby Drive, you know, I had kind of this feeling of, well, I've made it. This is, yeah, I did it, right? You know, in those days, there weren't thousands of people that had run Western States. There weren't, you know, webcasts and all this stuff. And there was all this knowledge. It was like, you didn't know where you were going, how hard it was going to be. But then when you got there, it was just so fulfilling that, you know, that last, you know, mile and a half was pretty amazing. So, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that for our live audience. Roby Drive. Where is that? What is it? How do they know that they're there? And can the monkey fall off the shoulders when they get to Roby?
Yeah, as long as you don't get there at like 29:45.
So you know, if you are going for the cutoff and it's getting 29:29, 29:39, Tim will be there. Yeah,
you don't want to see me.
And he's not as jovial as he is right now. In fact, I have heard rumors, it may be legend, that there's a whip involved. But he will do everything he can to get you in, barring putting you on his back.
Yeah, so Roby Drive is kind of an iconic spot, just because Wendell Roby's kind of the guy that got this thing off the ground to a certain point with the Tevis Cup ride and then becoming the run. He ran a bank in town and was kind of a mover shaker politically in the area. But you have about a mile and a quarter to go, but, you know, 2/3 of it's uphill. You got to get up over kind of the lip of the canyon and then down into the high school track to finish. But that's kind of a point where you've made it, because you're off the dirt trail. You're onto the pavement now. You can send 10 of your crew down there to shout you down all the way up the hill, or, you know, spray stuff on you or whatever you need to do to get in. But it's kind of the point at which you're back into civilization and headed to the finish line.
That's where the tears start flowing, I think, for a lot of runners, is once they hit the pavement, they realize that barring getting hit by a real car, they're going to make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a question to come up for both these guys. They've run it a total of 35 times. I'm going to ask them why. Why is it that they kept coming back? What's special about this race? But they're going to think about that. And this is really here for you guys. So if you guys have some questions for these two experts, you're the ones that are running the race. Scott and I aren't running the race tomorrow. At least we haven't heard that we are. So if you have some questions, we'd love for you to ask them and stand up and just shout them out over here. These guys will have the answers. You'll never be in front of two people that have more knowledge about this course. And I see that Megan's here. She has a lot of experience as well. Welcome, Megan.
And she's running it this year.
Yes, she is. Mm-hmm. So my question, why do you guys keep coming back? Why, Tim, did you sign up 25 times?
I think there's two reasons. It's kind of one of the things that Ian mentioned a little bit, which is after you've done it, you always go back in your mind and go, well, damn, I ran 17, you know, like you did your first time. But what kept you coming back? Because you knew you could run 17 something faster, right? You're like, if I would have just gotten in and out of that aid station a little quicker or, you know, not thrown up at mile 80, you know, I would have, you know, been able to be sixth rather than ninth.
How many into the 25 did you stop believing you could do a quicker one?
Well, you know, it's funny that it didn't take long. but I think there's another point there where I was talking about it, that there was a showing of the Across the Mountain movie the other night. I think, you know, for me, it was always, there's two other reasons. I loved being on the course race day. That's the thing I missed the most, because there's nothing like being on the course and going in and out of those aid stations, because you're out in the middle of nowhere and then you get into this place that's just so full of energy. And it's like you're at this concierge service of those people just want to get you in and get you out and get you on your way. But it's a blast while you're there. And so you just feel like everybody out there on the course that day is special. And the other one is, you know, I think for me, always running, I was always trying to find this level of harmony on the trail. Ooh. I was looking while I was running, right? There's this feeling like when you've got it going, it's great. It doesn't last forever. And you're always trying to tune the knobs as you go down, you know, whether it's metabolic or physical or spiritual or mental, you know, you're balancing all these things. And some of my best runs didn't necessarily be the fastest or, you know, the best place, but you were in that groove when you're out on the course, just going, how lucky am I to be out here? I'm at Western States. I've got it dialed in. I'm running down like Forest Hill Avenue to Forest Hill. Everybody's cheering. You're getting goosebumps on your arms as everybody's, you know, yelling at you, you know, and it's just, there's nothing like it.
Hey, Don, can you just believe the smile that Tim has on his face as he's describing this? He's run it 25 times, but how many times have you actually been on the entire course? 50?
Yeah, easy.
He knows the trail better than he knows his way home tonight.
So how about you, Ian? What brought you back so many times?
Definitely trying to get quicker. Mm-hmm. So I still don't believe I've run my quickest one.
Really?
I just was a minute off running a marathon PR couple of weeks ago, so I think there's still a bit of room to improve, but that's definitely part of it. You know, I like to be competitive and push myself, and I don't feel like I ever quite got it right at Western States. I had some good runs, but having that perfect day is so elusive that it could take, you know, 25 attempts literally to have the day, whether it's about the fastest run or the best run, for whatever that means to you. But also part of it was when I finished the first one, I said to my wife seconds after the finish, like, never doing that again. And that's the only race I've ever said that. So I don't normally say that. And then we were driving home, I said, you know what? I've got a guaranteed spot, and I know how I could shave a bit of time off here, a bit of time off there. Yeah. She goes, 2 hours ago, you said you were never going to do this. And I'm like, yeah, but I feel better now. So that's part of it, trying to improve.
I can almost feel my feet again.
Yeah, I couldn't feel that. Well, very numb at the end and bloated, but... And I think, just you get the whole community side of it. So I moved to the US late 2009. I've been here every year, either running it or pacing. This will be the second time I'm pacing it, apart from the year it was canceled because of COVID. So this is my June. This is like in America in June, this is what I do, because every year I've lived here, I've done it. So it's partly something that just feels like I should do it. And also partly that I really feel like I was missing out. Because this is where all my friends come. This is where people I coach come. This is where the whole community just comes together for one day, more so than any other ultra in the US. This is the one that really attracts people, whether they're pacing or whether they're in the race themselves. So it's just the community side of it that I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And I want to get back in. So I, you know, I'm not done yet.
Good, good. Any questions from the group? Anything that's, great. Stand up, say your name, and let us know your question.
And the question was, two questions. One is, what was the favorite section of the course? And what is maybe the hardest or most difficult part of the course?
Let's start with best part and hit that with Tim and then Ian, and then most difficult.
Yeah, my favorite section was always California Street, going from Forest Hill to the river. Mm. You know, you kind of got through the hardest part of the course. There's still some hard parts, but not anything compared to what you've had. And if you get there in one piece, it's just, you know, gorgeous single track for miles on end.
Give us context. California Street is what mile to what mile?
And it's about 62 to 78, give or take. And it's, you know, 16 miles to go from the town of Forest Hill to the river crossing. And, you know, you get down to the river and it's kind of nice and peaceful. You know, you've been bombing down, you know, single track for, you know, a couple of hours. And so it's just one of those places where if you can get there in one piece, it's a blast.
And you've made it through the hard canyons. Right. A lot of the heat's behind you. You have some shaded part. And it gives you another look at another a life to live.
Yeah. Whenever I got to Forest Hill, I just kind of mentally just said, well, only 7 hours to go. But that was it. You know, you start counting down rather than counting up, which is, you know, mentally soothing to think, OK, you know, I've done this a few times. I know how it works. And, you know, I know if I ran, you know, a normal finish, I'd be home in 7 hours.
Forest Hill is where there's a big party. It's the first party that you'll see. Besides the aid stations, anybody can go there. Your whole crew can be there. And there's just a ton of excitement. The whole town is just electric with people. And so you come in and you get that boost. And then it's a little deceiving because every time I think about going and running the Cal Street section, I think, oh, it's just downhill. It's just like so many, what, 15 miles, 16 miles downhill. But there are some uphills there. Right,
just to keep you honest.
So,
yeah.
So don't. There's a lot of downhill, and it's a lot of single track, and it's fun, and it's beautiful because you can just see the American River. But don't be dissuaded. There's some uphills there.
So, Ian, what's your favorite part of the course?
I'd say it's probably two bits. I love the mountains, the first 20 or 30 miles in particular, because mm-hmm. it's the most scenic. Like when you first get, it starts in the dark, so you get to the top of the first climb. It's the highest point in the race, about 4 miles in. Look over your shoulder and you've got dawn and you can see Lake Tahoe. So I always love that, just that last little bit of the climb, and there's lots of runners close together. So there's a bit mm-hmm. more of a community feel at that point, while mm-hmm. later in the race, you can be spread out and not really see other runners that much. And also you feel good. It's not super hot. You don't feel wrecked. So you can just enjoy mm-hmm. it. And people are actually laughing and joking through those sections. And then the other bit is just Forest Hill itself. It's really fun coming into that because then you know you've done the canyons mm-hmm. and it's just a boost because you see so many people there. There's big crowds, there's people you know there, and your own crew, of course. But then after that, like I don't like Cal Street nearly as much, but we'll do that bit in a second.
It's the place to pick up your pacer too.
Yes, yeah.
Ian, tell us a little bit, what are the canyons?
That's where the biggest climbs are, basically. So you keep going down, then up, and they're usually the hottest time of the day for most people. For the lead men, it's usually a little bit after that that you'll get the hottest time of the day, but it's where you've got the majority of the climbing, and it's what I think of as Western States. Like the canyons are the epitome of Western States because it's hot and there's a lot of hiking uphill and there's these long nonstop downhills on switchbacks. And there's three or four, depending kind of how you count it. But it starts really with Duncan Canyon, I suppose, just after mile 20 and goes all the way through to Volcano Canyon just before Forest Hill. So you've got that big chunk that is just going up and down with some long nonstop downhills, but it's categorized as kind of more like a mountain race of just big ups and downs.
And those downs are where you could possibly trash your quads. It's very runnable. And if you're not watching out for yourself, taking care of yourself, you can trash your quads. And then the uphills, especially coming like up to Devil's Thumb and up out of Volcano Canyon up to Michigan Bluff, there's a lot of switchbacks. In fact, you probably know how many switchbacks there are to Devil's Thumb, right?
I think there's 37.
They put a couple more in the last few years.
This gets harder to get. There's more switchbacks.
Yeah. Don, what's your favorite part
of Western States yeah. Trail? That trip around the track.
Yeah. I mean, that's good as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say mine is. I'm with Ian. The Forest Hill is really where that energy that's in the town and all the pacers and all the other runners and the crew. It puts a smile on your face and actually resurrected me.
And there's some road there. There's Bath Road that you come up when you come into Forest Hill and California Street. You're running on road, so you don't have to think about your feet for a few miles. And that's nice where you don't have to concentrate. You can just go automatic pilot. I'm not going to trip on something, because otherwise, if you don't pay attention to every step, something was going to take you out, a root, a rock, or something.
Okay, now we get to the negative. What is, both of you have run this many, many times. What is the section that you just wish you could cut and throw?
Before they put the Pucker Point in, which is really a cool trail and a major good ad, we used to run the dirt road from Dusty Corners to Last Chance, and it was pretty awful. There's nothing to see. It's kind of just this old, dusty, crummy road for 45 minutes, and it's and you're getting ready to get cooked in the canyons. So it's just like almost like this, you know, a barbecue-ready person going into the canyons on getting on that road. So now, you know, Pucker Point's a much better ad. It's shadier. It's more on a single-track trail, and it meanders around, and you look down into Screw Auger Canyon. It's kind of cool. The other one that and after they took that out, and I didn't have anything to complain about that. The other part is, you know, after you leave Auburn Lake Trails, you just can't wait to get through those, what's known as the horizontal canyons. There's three of them as you go in and out. Of when you leave at the Auburn Lake Trails aid station on the south side of the river, you kind of go in a small one, then in a real deep one, and it's the funny part is, you know, you can see people on the other side, and you can look back and see people behind you that are 15, 20 minutes behind you, because you go in and come right back out, and you're probably, I don't know, half a mile across, but you've done a mile of in and a mile back out. You look back, especially at night, you can see all the flashlights winding their way in and winding their way out. And just mentally, I just say, okay, just shut up and run 20 minutes and you'll be over there. And then you'll be out of this. And then, of course, you turn the corner and you can hear the music. In the old days, back, they used the music at Brown's Bar. And you think, oh, I'm almost there. And then it'd still take you forever to get there.
Let's talk about the Brown's Bar aid station. There's some interesting stuff that goes on at Brown's Bar, isn't there, Tim?
I haven't been there since they moved it down to the quarry road. But it gets pretty crazy in there.
There's a little bit of a party going on, as I recall.
We had a little bit there for a while because it was just getting a little bit out of hand. But yeah, that's the closer you get to the finish, the more jolly the aid stations get.
The longer they've been out there aiding.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Ian, what about you? What section of the course would you wish that you could take out?
I've never enjoyed the last 20 miles because it's just miserable at that point. You just want to be done. So after the river, you've got a little bit of a climb. So the river's 78, a little bit of a climb up to mile 80. And in the last 20, even if I felt good at that point and moving well, I really just want to be done because it's nice enough, but it's not as scenic as earlier parts of the course. And the heat has just really got to you at that point. So, and also in many of the years, I've been like a minute away from the guy ahead, a minute from the guy behind. So there's maximum pressure that you can't afford to back off. So you're really racing hard. It's exhausting. And I've never, ever enjoyed. I've never enjoyed the last 20 miles of any 100 miler, in fairness.
Sounds like you need to start running more
80. I need to do some 80 milers, yeah.
No matter how much you train, no matter how much advice you get, your stomach can take you out of a race. And that's why we choose UCAN.
UCAN has been a great partner and a great partner for Trail Runner Nation members. They have two deals going on through the end of July. We twisted their arms, and this is what they're offering. If you've never tried UCAN products, they have a sample pack where you can try it out. It includes this, Freeman, two Edge Energy gels, two of their bars, and two packets of the energy powder. You get all of that for free where you just pay the $6.95 for shipping.
They're doing this because they know if you try it, you'll like it, you'll see that it works.
The better deal, though, Freeman, is their starter pack. They're calling it the Trail Runner Nation starter pack. It includes a full box of the bars, a full box of the Edge Energy gels, and you get all of that for a 20% discount. Good only through the end of July. Go to our deals tab at trailrunnernation.com.
Yeah, I'm ready for some more questions. You guys have better questions and more pertinent questions than I think Scott and I could even think about. Do you guys have any questions about what's waiting for the runners Saturday morning? Good, thank you. Mike from Australia.
Good, dang, man, good. That's philosophical.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he said we were
prepared for deep questions.
Well, he also said that our snakes aren't as
venomous
as they're down in Australia. So, what are the metaphorical snake bites? What kind of things should runners look out for that typically might take somebody out? The things that the aid station workers are focused and concentrated on.
I would say most of them are going to be mental. Your legs are going to hurt. That's guaranteed. You're going to be tired. You're going to be hot. So different degrees of that probably won't be something that forces you to have to stop. It'll be a choice to stop for many people, that they're just not willing to suffer enough or to keep going on when their legs are trash and everything feels hopeless. So I would say that the biggest one is just being able to overcome that. And part of that is if you prepare yourself for the worst. So if you're ready for your legs to feel horrible, you're ready to feel completely delirious with heat, you're ready to have your stomach feel like crap and you're vomiting. If you think of all the things that could go wrong and you assume that some of those will probably happen, then whenever they're not, it's bonus miles. Like if you're moving along, even if it's slowly and you feel kind of okay, then that is going to just eat up some miles, and then you just try and eat up a few more feeling good and a few more and a few more. But I'd say that the biggest one is just, yeah, if you can kind of change your, not to be a pessimist, but change your baseline to be things will go wrong, then anything above that is good and your mental state will stay better versus you think, oh, well, when I feel good, I'll run well. And then any little setback knocks you down and makes you start being negative and having horrible things going on in your head on repeat.
Good, good. How about you, Tim?
I was going to say there. I can think of a couple as usually the ones that I think everyone struggles with. We see at the aid stations. The first one is kind of that water, food, salt balance. It's a hard problem to solve, but you got to be thinking about that all the time. The majority of the people that have problems in the race either get dehydrated and start getting sick, or you know make heating mistakes and get sick, and then you got to pretty much stop or slow down and rehab and get started again. You can't just keep going full gas, or you may not make it. The other one is that's going to happen is your feet are going to turn to total crap. And I always think, we used to get to the river crossing, be like, "Wait, you change your shoes at the river." I said, at that point, it's too late, right? By the time I'd sit down and change my socks and change my shoes and get going, I can't make up that time. If you're running, that Ian's running 16, 30 or something, you sit there for 4 or 5 minutes, you can never make that up.
And I just like to say, though, it's not, you don't have to get blisters. It is possible to do this race with your feet being fine at the end. I've done it maybe 5 out of 10 times that way. Yeah. And I know other guys have, but most people, yeah, it'll happen.
Yeah, you're done by the time people are still back in Forest Hill.
It's the same terrain, the wet feet and everything. But if you've practiced that enough and you've had other races, it is feasible to not have your feet go completely to hell.
Yeah, and that race is called the Tevis Cup. It's on a horse.
then your butt goes to hell.
How that top part, after you go over the top and you go through the wilderness area, that we used to say, if there's not water pouring over the tops of your shoes, you're on the wrong trail. So you're going to get wet. In the first 10 miles, you're going to have water pouring into your shoes. And then it's a matter of managing that and, whether you have extra socks or you change at Robinson or whatever, because you're going to cross a wet crossing at Duncan Creek as well. You're going to get wet there. And there's a couple other streams. You can probably step through those a little higher with the kind of snow we're going to have. But, it seems like, sooner or later, most of the times your feet fall apart. But I'm not sure there's much you can do. Yeah, you can sit down for 20 minutes and have you fix it, but I'm not sure you're going to go that much faster after that. You're still going to have feet that are kind of wrecked. Just keep going.
Well, I would say because I have an issue with blisters. And if I was to give any tips is if you start to feel a hot spot, take care of it early. Mm-hmm. The aid station workers are phenomenal. They have their foot kits there. And just if you get to an aid station and you're feeling some hot spots, just ask for some help and they'll be on you. They'll tape you up and do whatever it takes to help get you to Auburn. Mm-hmm.
I have an alternate strategy as well that I used one time, which was I could feel a blister and it was really annoying. And I was going downhill out of Forest Hill. There's a couple of miles that are quite steep downhill. And I thought, if I just go harder, I'll pop the blister and it won't hurt as much. And it worked.
Yep.
You'll know when you pop a blister while you're running, because when you go through the river, you'll know right away. Yes. Trust me on that.
You'll hear a little girl screaming in the raft.
And sometimes it's nice not to take the shoe off, because once you see it, then you acknowledge it's there. It's better left.
But it's painful to take the shoe off and put it back on as well.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yep. That's true. So we've got 2 items so far out of the 3 that you've asked for. So we're keeping track. Mike, what else do we have? Do we have anything else that runners should be aware of that's unique about this course? One thing you just mentioned, Tim, is you said the word snow. And that's always, every year, that's in the conversation. What kind of snow is up there? So do you anticipate some snow?
And there might be a few hundred yards, but that's it. Maybe just at the very top of the climb. Mm-hmm. Just coming over the lip at going over the top at Emigrant Gap and the monument there. But other than that, there's going to be a lot of water in the wilderness area. But I don't think snow-wise there's going to be any.
Yes, and some years there's 20 miles of snow that you won't make it through.
We've alluded to the heat. Let's talk about the heat. At this point, there's no heat training left. If you didn't do any heat training, don't stress about it. You're going to be starting the race without heat training. If you did it, hopefully that'll help. But how do you manage the heat? And let's get into these canyons. So, it's 95 degrees here today. I think my truck's at 101 as I was driving here. It's going to be a hot couple days. How do you manage the heat of this race, Ian?
The main thing is getting ice and liquids at the aid station. So don't just assume that if you're feeling hot, that drinking will cool you down. You also need to pour it on your head. You should be running most of the race with a wet t-shirt because that'll be then evaporating and cooling you off. I'd also say cover up as much skin as possible. It sounds counterintuitive, but having like arm sleeves, a t-shirt, a buff, a hat, because otherwise you get the direct radiation of the heat onto the skin. We have Pam Smith here. I know you like wearing a cotton t-shirt and allowing that to stay wet for longer. I think a technical t-shirt can work as well as long as you keep getting it wet. But the key thing is make use of the aid stations and make use of every time you go past water, whether it's pooled water or a little stream, splash it on yourself, dip your hat in it. If it's a really hot day and it may well be, it's looking pretty hot at the moment, lie down in it, just keep your head above the water for 2 seconds and it's well worth your time. But in particular, stuff that's below the air temperature. So getting ice from the aid stations, putting it in a buff, in a hat, in arm sleeves. For women, you can put it in your sports bra as well. But if you haven't done that before, maybe don't try it for the first time on race day. But then also put it in bottles. So this is why I prefer handheld bottles rather than having a backpack, because then you can have a bottle with ice in it, pour it on your head, and maybe you get 15 minutes where you still got colder ice type stuff before it's all melted. And so if it takes 1 to 2 hours, say, between most aid stations, depending on the pace, maybe a little bit more later on. If you can have at least the first 15 minutes feel good, then you've got less time where you're gradually heating up. So really prioritize keeping yourself wet and having, like, don't rush through the aid station. Get ice from them. It's worth that extra minute or two, especially during the hottest parts of the day.
And I did see a tweet by Craig Thornley, the race director, that said he's ordered 36,000 pounds of ice. So there's going to be ice out there. Don't skimp on the ice.
I'm interested in hearing how Tim managed the heat through his years, but I'll just add one thing about the water. Don't show up to an aid station with water in your bottle. I mean, that's crazy. Either if you can't drink it, put it on you, let it cool you down, but you're going to get more water at an aid station. They're well supplied and well stocked here.
Yeah, I'd have to second what Ian said. It's really important to stop at every stream you can get into and get in or do something to get yourself wet. There's plenty of it all the way along the course. There's a few places along Red Star where there's no water and, you know, a few other places. But anytime you're crossing a creek or you can see water, you need to go down there and, you know, douse off and stay cooled off. I think that's a choice you can make. You know, you don't have to go very far out of your way and it'll make a big, I always thought about the one when you cross the swinging bridge below Devil's Thumb and then there's that little spring right after that, right? And you lay down in there, he's like, wow, you know, this feels great. But you know, 5 minutes up the hill, you feel like you're getting baked again, right? Like what happened? I was just so pleasant 5 minutes ago and now I feel like I'm getting barbecued again.
But under the river as well. You know, if you're really overheating getting down there, just give yourself a minute in the water there because that's the cold water because it's rather than like a pool that's been heated up, that's all cold. And that's fun. Every time I've got there, I've wished I could stay there rather than having to do that last 20 miles bit afterwards.
Yeah, I think the other one is just, you know, just stay hydrated early when it's real easy to daydream and you feel good and you're not necessarily drinking or eating because that it's the middle part of the course where you don't want to have to worry about eating and drinking because it's really, really hard. You know, your body's going to go like, hey, shoot, I don't want to digest that bologna sandwich. I just want to run, right? So if you can stay topped off by the time you get into the hardest part of the course, then you don't have to worry about it too much. And then when you get back to the easier parts, you can get going again. But I think that's one of the trickiest parts. You know, this course has a lot of different challenges, but that I think that's the one, you know, managing the heat is the one that knocks the most people out if they mismanage it.
If you weren't listening very closely, I just figured out what Tim's trick is to 25 runs under 24 hours. Bologna sandwiches. I've never had a bologna sandwich in any race that I've run or any training run. I'm going to go get me some bologna tonight.
You probably get a amount of salt in that.
You've got to ask for it at the aid stations. They don't put it on the table.
Yeah. Again, back to the context thing about temperature, and we may need to do some math into metric here. If it's going to be 101, 105 degrees here in Auburn.
So about a bit over 40, that would be. It might not be quite that high, but close to 40 is likely.
40 degrees Celsius?
Celsius, yeah.
Celsius. So those that in the world that actually are smart and use metric, 40 degrees Celsius. But in the canyons are fairly steep, and it's big granite rock, so they're radiating the heat. It doesn't cool down there at night, where if you're on the top of the ridges and anywhere else, sometimes there's a little bit of a breeze and it cools down. In those canyons, it's a heat sink, and it just bakes. So in the bottoms of those canyons, it can get really hot. I've never measured it, but I've heard 110,
I'll give you a note.
250 degrees Fahrenheit
feels like.
Bob and I went down to El Dorado Bridge last year at about 2:30, 3 o'clock, and it was probably well over 100 at the bottom of the canyon there, and the thermometer's in the shade. And it stayed that way, but when the sun finally got behind on the other side of the canyon, so it was shady down there, went down to about 90. So, I mean, there's a big difference between when you're in the sun and the sun's up and beating on you and when you're in the shady part of the course, for sure.
Did you ever think about starting the race at night so we didn't have to deal with that heat through the canyons, Tim? No. I mean, you've been...
No. Hey, Don, if it's over 24 hours, you still have day and night.
Don, for some of us, we used the entire Saturday night to run the race, so...
I'm with you. You had something to say earlier, Ian, about something I'd like to learn.
Yeah, so I think the key thing as well is it looks like it could be quite hot around the start in the next few days as well. So don't wait until you get hot to start doing the cooling down. In the first 20-odd miles, it probably won't be super hot, but still pour water on your head, maybe get some ice. Try and kind of pre-cool yourself just to stay as comfortable as possible. There's no need to wait until you get to the canyons and you're boiling and then try and cool yourself down because it's already a bit late then.
Good. Any other questions out here from the group so far? Your questions have been much better than ours.
You know, I was going to add one to
add
my Aussie buddy over here about to be afraid of, and that is hanging out too much in the aid stations. The aid stations are like these giant cool parties that be at. And when you're out in the middle of nowhere and then you finally get there, like, hey, this is really cool. I think I'll stay here for a while because it's way better than out there in the heat by myself wandering in the weeds. And so, I mean, the aid stations, there's some that are literally perched on the side of the trail. And there's, really, you know, there's Cal One, you know, what is that, Dardanelles? You know, it's basically, a 6x8 platform on the side of the trail. And the whole thing could collapse and fall into the river if you're not careful. But you get them in there and it's real nice to stay there. But, you know, you can spend a lot of time there if you're not careful.
Yeah, well, knowing what's in between Cal 1 and Cal 2, there's quite a bit of work to get there. So.
Ice cream sandwiches, no?
Oh. Hey, I have a question about the trail. Tim and Ian and Don, you've all raced internationally. How would you describe the groomedness? Is that a word, groomedness, of the trail on Western States versus like a European race? I know we have a lot of volunteers that as soon as the snow, even before the snow starts melting, there's crews out there that are cutting down the fallen trees and really buffing out the trail. Is it pretty groomed? Is it pretty easy trail or technical?
It's not too technical. The mountains have some little technical bits in the early miles, but most of it is what you think of as the kind of buffed out California trails. You can still trip on a pebble, but it's not super technical.
Done it.
No, that's mainly what I would trip on. I don't trip on the technical bits. It's after the technical bit, that's when you have to concentrate. And there's lots of bits where you could easily just not be looking or get a little dizzy and then still take a tumble.
Tim's usually, I think you own a few chainsaws, don't you, Tim? And you get out there yourself.
Yeah.
How does the trail look this year?
Yeah, I think it's great. You know, the one challenge we have every year is, the whole course has been hit over the last, 20 some years of big forest fires, right? We had one out in Duncan Canyon, which kind of took out part of Red Star Ridge and then Duncan right down by the creek. So that's not as pretty as it used to be. And then for the next 20 years, you have trees dying and falling into the trail. And so it's a lot of work. That's a long way to go to cut trees. And the other one is on a section that I'm on. Well, we have the one at Devil's Thumb as well. The climb to Devil's Thumb looks completely different than it did 10 years ago. It's much more exposed. What happens when the forest burns and then you get a bunch of weird plants growing in, and in the high country, it's whitethorn, and other places you get other plants that grow in to replace it. And it's just not as pretty as it was. And the one that I'm struggling with on my section along California Street, right before you get to Ford's Bar, there was a fire in there about 5 years ago, and just continually trees dying and falling into the trail, rock slides, and that kind of stuff. So it's pretty much when we can get in there, it's a year-long program to kind of keep those up between, keeping the trees off the trail and then making repairs.
Tim, maybe a question for you. You might know, how many man hours or person hours is put in each year to keep the Western States Trail and Tevis Cup Trail open?
Oh, it's probably, 1,000 hours easy. We did just one day on just to open up California Street in back in January, I want to say. And we did like 75 hours that day across two full crews, high part, low part, chainsaws, all that stuff. And we just did 100 hours in that one day. And that was pretty much an easier part of, because it's hard, it's easier to get to, you get in and out. But someplace like going to Duncan or Red Star, that's an all day effort for, several people.
A lot of man hours, people hours to keep the course open, and people volunteering during the race itself. How many volunteers? How many?
For the race, it's over 1,000 volunteers. So I think it's a little over 1,000, split across all those aid stations, and then the part that you forget, there's guys running runner tracking, you know, doing radio. We've got sweep teams out there. You've got, you know, every aid station has the regular volunteers, and then you might have medical as long as that's a different crew. Then you have some guys that are doing just feet. They're just feet nerds. So they're taking care of people's feet.
I love feet nerds, by the way.
There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that you never see. Like the guys that I was just communicating a few hours ago, because I'm going to go mark the first part of the course up to the top through the ski resort. And the guy that marks the rest of the course, he goes all the way from the last 96 miles and he works all week. I mean, he's shuttling back and forth, throwing out, you know, flags and pin flags and little directional arrows, and it's a 4 or 5 day effort to do the rest of the course.
Is it just one person doing most of it?
Well, they kind of lead the thing. It's kind of like some of the trail work. There's a trail lead for a section, and this guy, he's in charge of marking the course, and he has other people that help him. But there's, you know, trying to do a section like, you know, Red Star to, you know, somewhere else, you got to shuttle cars and you got to get other people to pick you up. It's a lot of coordination for sure.
That brings up a good question. What is the trail markings like? How hard is it to get lost? How easy is it to get lost?
You go first, Tim, then I'll say.
You got to work really.
Sounds like Ian has a story.
You got to work really, really hard to get lost.
You have to work really hard.
And I, like I said, with a lot of stuff, and some sort of races are better, that it's part of the sport, paying attention and following the trail. You know, there's no handrail out there that you clip to and just wander around, and it keeps you on the path, right? You have to pay attention, and you have to know where you're going. Even on the training run, it kind of cracks us up, because we do the training run on Memorial Day weekend, and we get the Cal 2. We get this whole aid station. Invariably, out of the 200 people go, some of them try to take the road past all the cars. There's no ribbons. There's nothing to make them go that way. But they're like, oh, you're near. And you're like, no, get over here. You're going the wrong way. Follow the pink flags, okay? It's pretty simple.
Yellow
flags.
Pink
flags, you go that way.
And yellow on race day, right?
No, it's pink.
Oh, pink now?
Yeah, we're using pink. It's just easier to see, particularly in the snow. So, you know, we always have a few, you know, that just, they try really hard, and sometimes they're successful. But the course will be very well marked. You probably won't go more than a couple of minutes without seeing a pin flag in the trail.
If you're running as fast as Jim Walmsley the first time he ran, you know, he there was a little bit of a diversion there. But Ian, what about you? What do you think?
I think I've had three times where I added on about a mile. One of them was in the snow, and it was much harder to mark through there. And a couple other ones around the middle. So I made sure then I did the training camps the month before, so it'd be fresh in my mind to remember some of the sections through there. But particularly because they used to use yellow markers, and there were some yellow markers for some other reason one of the years. And so I followed them for a bit. And I was like, these are a slightly different color, and they don't say Montrail, but they're yellow. And I realized that luckily sooner rather than later. But yeah, if you're not paying attention. Or another year, there was a dog came along, and that distracted me. So then I missed a turn with that, as did Paul Giblin. And so we both added on some time and then turned back. And
that was the crew from the guy in front of you.
Yes, it's good distraction
from behind
them.
Me.
Yeah, but there were these three dogs just jumping up at us. So we were running along before the turn to go down to Volcano Canyon just after halfway. And we missed the turn because we were just like trying to avoid getting bitten by these dogs. But it is very well marked, but you do need to look out.
Good. Any questions? Question is wildlife. Will you see wildlife out there? There are stories in years past where there's been bear sightings where it's actually held up the front runners. Rattlesnakes. I bumped into Tim the other day as I was running where he started talking. And all the years that I've been running out here, I'm probably the only person. I've never seen a rattlesnake running. And I think that's
anywhere
pretty.
Anywhere or just on this?
Anywhere up here in Auburn, Western States Trail, I've never seen a rattlesnake, but that doesn't mean they're not there. What about you guys?
I've never seen wildlife really here. I'm not great at seeing snakes. I've been told, oh, you just missed a snake. Like, wait, I didn't see that. But so I maybe have been near snakes in this race and didn't realize.
That may be my problem.
But I've never noticed snakes here. I've never seen bears here, never seen cougars here. Dogs were the one distraction I had. But yeah, there was the year, I think it was, 2011, Ellie Greenwood's first win, where the lead women all got concertinaed together about 2 miles from the finish on the final climb, where there was a bear, mother, and cub. And so that was just blocking the trail, and it's single tracks. You can't go around it. Ellie, I think, just managed to skirt round, and she was already in the lead. But then the next two or three women got close together, and it ended up being a sprint around the track. So I think that was Nikki Kimball and Cammie Semick were literally head-to-head. And they're both 100K women's team members from the US. So they're fast roadrunners too. But they were head-to-head, I think, for second. Does that sound right, Tim? For that year?
Yeah. I think that sounds right. Yeah. What about you? You live up here.
I live up here. I was going to say, I haven't seen a bear for a while, and then I've had a bear cub in my yard twice in the last 2 weeks, eating plums out of my tree, little rat. But that's probably the most likely thing you'll see, because the bears tend to hang around, and then but they'll get startled really quickly, and you'll see them just run off. You know, there's rattlesnakes around, but your chances of seeing one's pretty small. Hey, there was a female runner from Europe somewhere last year that saw a puma. She called it a puma over there on the Auburn Lake Trail side, over by above Brown's Bar.
Was that a hallucination? Yeah. Maybe.
Could have been. Hey.
The thing to know about bears is these bears are black bears, and they're usually scared of people. Mm-hmm. So if you just make some noise, you'll scare them, and they'll typically run off. So you don't
unless they have a cub. Then be careful.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Good point. Good point, Ian.
Actually, I can say one more thing actually about the reason to have a pacer for me personally was so I'd have someone near the end when it's getting to twilight, and I didn't want a cougar to think, oh, there's a single person on their own to attack. So it gave me peace of mind to have a pacer in the latter stages or through the night, depending on where you have the pacer. But that's a good reason. And also that person could be looking out for course markings for you. They can be looking out for snakes for you. Mm. Good tactic, though, is have the pacer behind you, because with a snake, the first person disturbs it and it bites the second one. So as the runner, you don't want to get bitten. But your pacer, they're fine. You know, they've got all the time in the world to get to hospital.
Same thing with the bears. You want to make sure they're behind you, because they're fresher legs. They can outrun you. So if you can guard the trail with some elbows, keep them behind, the bear will get them first.
I had one of those weird ones last year. I was working on some trail maintenance down around Sandy Bottom, which is like, what, mile 76, 75, right along the river in the grass where it's kind of steamy down there. And I'm walking through and I can hear this rattlesnake clear as day. I just can't see him.
Ooh.
He's in the grass next to me, you know, hey, you're not where I want you to be. And like, oh, I had my dog. And let's go, man. If you can't see him, it's a little unnerving. But they're around, but you probably won't run into any.
So for our international runners, that for many races over there, you don't have pacers. We have them here. The job of the pacer is to sacrifice themselves for the runner. So
tell good jokes.
It's very, very important to have that pacer with you, except one if somebody's volunteering in Forest Hill to guide you and bring you down. They'll sacrifice themselves.
Mm-hmm. Questions? The question is rules for pacers. Western States has a paragraph or two about that, Tim. What does the paragraph say?
So I think the first one is there's what we call no muling. So your pacer cannot carry anything you need. You have to be self-contained. Your flashlight, your drinks, your food, your supplies. The pacer has to be self-contained as well. And then the other one that is pretty obvious is that we've kind of had to do was the runner and the pacer have to leave the aid station, go in and leave together. Ideally, right? You don't want to have the runner go in and go, okay, well, yeah, I'll take this, and then leave the pacer behind, or have the pacer go in and say, hey, my runner needs X, Y, and Z. Because what we're trying to do is create a very fair playing field. And that's one way of doing that, such that there are going to be runners that don't have pacers. But we don't want the people that do have pacers to have a competitive advantage. So all those rules have been put into place to try to create as best a playing field as we can. The other one is obviously your pacer cannot assist you in any way as far as, you know, picking you up and, you know, shouldering you into the aid station because you twisted your ankle or something or whatever. You have to propel yourself the entire 100 miles. Now, that's different if you're in an aid station, you're sitting in a chair and you want to get up and somebody gives you, you know, a little, that's just, you know, normal aid station protocol. But you know, if you crash and burn out there and somebody's carrying you to the aid station, then you want to continue. That's definitely a violation.
I'm not sure if there's another race that does this, but we talked about Forest Hill. And some runners don't plan on having pacers, and they get to Forest Hill and they reconsider. One of the cool things about Forest Hill is there's just volunteers there that are ready to pace. And they've gone up there and they are waiting for runners that need pacers. And it's actually a really cool thing that I think Western States does. They're still doing it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at pacers. I know I felt this way. I paced my son, I don't know, what, 4 years ago. I felt that there's a huge responsibility. I was like more nervous doing that than I was running the race, because he was, you know, really just trying to cheat the cutoffs the whole day. He had, you know, he could hear the horn when he left most of the middle aid stations, which you really don't want to do. That is a little frightening and haunting. You know, when you're rolling out of the aid station, you're like, oh, they're coming after me. But it is super. The really advantage one of the pacers have, particularly if you don't know the course, is how much longer is it to the next aid station? So you can understand, do I drink now or do I drink later? Should I eat now? Should I eat later? What's between me and the next aid station? Is it uphill? Is it downhill? Is it, you know, windy? Are we on dirt road? Are we on pavement? Are we on, you know, single track? You know, all that kind of stuff is good to know. So if you don't have a pacer, it'd be great to have one, particularly most of the people that volunteer in Forest Hill are really good course knowledge guys. Yeah. They're there because they really want to help and take somebody in. And, you know, I have to say, we ended up making it that year, but, you know, it took a lot of effort, and we were doing everything we could as pacers to, you know, keep people moving.
And pacers are out there to help you, and you're allowed to instruct them, hey, don't talk so much. I need silence right now. You're allowed to say that stuff. They're not there to ruin your race. They're so anxious to help you that they'll do anything. And if you're only asking them to be quiet, they don't mind that. So
there's even things that may border on the moral or ethical that they're willing to do for you.
Such as?
Don was my pacer when I ran, and there's some things that he did that we don't talk about.
What happens on the trail stays on the trail.
One of the other iconic things of Western States, if there's many iconic things, is the river crossing. This is the American River, and depending on the year, there's different ways that they cross the river. Sometimes there's a cable and you have to propel yourself across the river holding onto the cable. Sometimes there's so much water that you have to raft across, and they have professional rafters that take you across. What is this year look like, Tim?
I think we're definitely crossing on foot.
Crossing,
and, you know, there's not that much snow in the Sierras, and we have to work with the local utility agencies because that all the water on the Middle Fork is regulated for rafting and everything else. So we turn the water off, I don't know, it's like 10 in the morning because it takes that long for it to get down to where we cross by 4 o'clock, which is kind of around maybe one of the leaders would have to cross there. So we regulate the water much lower than it would be on a normal day there. And then there's a big steel cable attached, a rope and a steel cable together, so you have something to hold on to. That's rule number one, crossing over, don't let go of the rope. Okay, the Walmsley rule. Don't try to swim it. It's actually pretty fast, yeah, if you really get in there. It doesn't look like much, but when you get in there, you can really feel it pushing on you, and all the rocks are super slippery. It's real easy to just slip and, you know, get a nice bath, but don't let go of the rope.
From experience, sometimes as you're crossing on foot, I'm a short guy, and sometimes it would come up past my waist. I've lost an iPhone. Like, not lost it physically, but forgot it was in my pocket. And went
you
across
race with your iPhone.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got a new
one. He's one of those guys.
Tim and I both had the same reaction.
Did you get a picture of you?
Anyway.
That's what your pace is for. They can have the iPhone, yeah, take photos
the best
on
part,
you.
Too, there'll be people on the rope holding it steady for you, because you can imagine if you held on to the thing and start swaying back and forth, you could move, you know, quite a bit. So there's people standing in the river most of the evening and night and making sure you get across safely.
Well, before we wrap up, are there any other questions out there? I do want to recognize Bob Crowley, who asked the great question about pacers. He puts this together each year, and the reason we're here, the four of us today, is it was his vision to bring us together. We're going to have a barbecue at 5 o'clock, and he puts that together. There's a lot of housing that he puts together for people that come in, and he matches them with pacers. He really works hard because he loves the community, and we're lucky to have him as part of it. So, Bob Crowley, thank you very much for doing what you do. Any other questions before we wrap up? Because the last one I have for these two.
Wait, long as we're thanking people, let's thank Paulo and the aid station for hosting us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. If you don't have the arm sleeves and the buff like Ian was talking about, I'm sure that Paulo can hook you up. He has lots of good stuff here.
And some handhelds, right? We've got handhelds here.
And beer.
And beer.
He does have beer. The last two questions I have for these guys as you're thinking about yours is, if you're going to speak to a runner right before they start and they've got their bib on, they're ready to go, it's countdown, there's 4 minutes till the gun goes off. What do you tell that runner? What do you say right to their face to carry them 100 miles down the trail? That's what I'm going to ask each one of you. Does anybody have a question to close it out here?
I will tell you right now, I know Ian's is going to be something very serious.
So we better start with him.
And Tim's is going to be something that's maybe a little off color.
Oh, so we better start with Ian. Let's start with Ian. And
when you asked the question, I could see the corners of Tim's mouth kind of turning up, going, oh, I'll tell you what I'll tell them.
Ian, what would you tell that runner?
Given I've got a load of people I'm coaching who are going to be there as well, this is exactly what I'll be saying to them, which is, don't get carried away. You're going to be like all this adrenaline and excitement when the gun goes off. And there's the biggest climb of the day is the start of the race to the highest point from altitude point of view. So don't hammer up there. There's no need to run every step just because you can. Just use that as a warm-up. Mm-hmm. Think of that purely as the warm. There's no need to be a certain point in the field. I think I've been like 40th place there and then 10 miles later be 10th. There's just no need because everyone's close together anyway. Mm-hmm. But there's often a little bit, particularly some of the elite people who are here, you might get caught up trying to race each other or, well, that guy's running so I can't show weakness. Ignore that. Do your own race. There's no rush at that point. There'll be a couple of minutes between the top people at the top, whether you run it or hike lots of it. So hold back and then enjoy the mountains. Think of that as the warm-up as well. Like 20 or 30 miles, you want to be fresh when you get through to 50K or so. Otherwise, you're in a lot of trouble.
That's good advice.
Good advice.
Tim.
I got a couple of stories.
Oh, we're here. We're down with the story. We've got room left here. Go ahead.
I was coming out of the wilderness area, headed over to Lion Ridge one year. And I was, you know who you're supposed to run with, right? I mean, if Ian, he looks around and he knows most of the people. I'm looking around this one time and I see this guy. He's really not one of the guys I recognize. I wonder where this guy is from. You know, so we're talking and he's like, hey, yeah, it's my first time. Like, yeah, you have a good time. So, yeah. And I go, he says, you've run this before? And I said, yeah, a few times. And he goes, oh, yeah, what'd you run last year or something? And I said, I don't know. I said something like, 1730. And he just hit this guy. He hit the emergency brake. And what the hell am I doing here? Because we were on, 1730 pace at mile 10. And this guy's trying to break 24, just finish. And you could just, that's exactly the example of the end. You get so caught up in that start. You've been waiting so long to run Western States. You're at altitude. It's straight uphill. You're super excited. It's really,
but you're fresh, yeah. And that adrenaline makes you think you can do anything. So mm-hmm. You got to rein it in. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll say, that first 20 miles is really a fantastic 20. Like you were saying, really pretty. It's a chance to just enjoy the day. You're actually in good spirits for sure then, because you probably won't be later on at mile 80. You'll be grumpy and ornery and whatnot. So it's a good place to enjoy it. But I had this experience last year, and I think it really depends on whether you're trying to race the race or you're just trying to finish. This guy came to me before the race, and it was going to be 100 last year, and it's not going to be quite that hot this year. But he said, what would you do? And I said, listen, man, it's going to just cook in the middle of this course. Run for the first 6 hours. Get some mileage behind you when it's nice and cool before the sun gets up. And then when you start to sweat and really get cooked, shut it down. Turn off. Don't let the middle of the course beat you. And then when sun goes down again, then get it, rev it back up. So you'll have some gas left at the end. And he finished like 29 hours or something. And he came up to me afterwards and said, man, I thought, he was so excited. But I think, the thing that I always think about when I'm out there, and I was never the fastest guy for sure, most talented runner, but I was always trying
for five times.
Well, but it wasn't like I was the fastest guy that day. There were other faster guys than me. What's the trail telling me right now? What is it telling me I should be doing right now? Mm. Such that given the skills that I have, am I a 20-hour runner? Am I a 24-hour runner? Or am I a 30-hour runner? What is it telling me to do right now? Should I be walking? Should I be drinking? Should I be eating? Should I be resting? Should I be pushing? But it's talking to you all that way, and you just got to listen and then perform to what it's telling you to do, and you'll be fine.
Well, and by the way, when it speaks to you, it speaks in multiple languages. You don't need a translator.
You dumbass.
Well, we really appreciate getting to share this with you guys. Yep. Ian Sharman with Sharman Ultra Coaching. He has a number of runners here that he's taking care of and making sure that they follow their and meet their goals. And we really appreciate Ian for being here. So thank you, Ian.
Who are you pacing, by the way?
He's just sitting right there, Tom Owens.
All right.
Yeah. Hey, drop him. There's nothing better than a runner than dropping your
pace. This is why I've been doing a lot of heat training, so hopefully, so that doesn't happen, because it would be really embarrassing.
Leave him at an aid station.
But if he does, that's a good sign.
And of course, we want to thank Tim Tweetmeyer, who's had this race on his shoulders for a long time and is a real local legend and I think a global legend. He's great for the sport. So thank you, Tim Tweetmeyer.
Thanks, guys. And if you see him on the course later in the race, know that there's nobody that can get you into the finish line. If you don't see him, thank God that you didn't see him.
That's right.
So thank you guys for putting up with us for a period of time.
Now go out and run.
Mas.
And now we've reached the end of the podcast, really the finish line, Scott, where we give high fives as we're coming through the big arch. And we're going to thank our executive producer and editor, Ryan Warr.
And our social media guru, Yana Gibalova.
And our website graphic engineer, Katie Burke.
We also want to thank the Patreon supporters. If you want to become one, you can go to our website, hit the Support Us tab, and you can sign up on our Patreon channel. We also want to thank our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley. Doug Crumley is a coach for your finances. He is a private wealth advisor with Crumley & Associates, which is a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC. When you have the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Visit him at www.dougcrumleyjr.com.
Scott, we mentioned the deals page quite often. That's on our website, trailrunnernation.com. And we've made a lot of changes there, and we're really proud of it.
There's a lot of information there. Of course, there's the deals page where you can get all sorts of discounts on gear that we love and trust. We also have all of our other podcasts. We also have the Training Principles link. So we just started the Training Principles episodes at the beginning of this year. All those are kind of organized in one area. So if you're just getting into trail running and want to know the basics of where to start, go to the Training Principles tab. You can also sign up for our newsletter. We don't fill your mailbox full of junk every week or twice a week. Only when there's important things to happen, you'll also be notified when a new podcast hits the air.
So go to trailrunnernation.com.